Seriously, the purpose tonight is not to scare anybody. The purpose tonight is to discuss important issues. And I start from the premise that the FBI and the CIA have absolutely critical roles to play in protecting America. And from covering law enforcement for 20 years, I know these agencies are made up of very dedicated, hardworking people, and they deserve the tools they need, and they deserve our support. The purpose here is to ask reasonable and constructive questions that will ultimately give us the information we need for informed decision making and so make our nation stronger. These are questions that come straight from the smoking craters of the World Trade Center, from the air-conditioned, top-secret compartmented halls of the CIA, and from the elected chambers of Congress. Consider the following. Since September 11th, the Bush administration and Congress have dramatically increased the government's power to investigate and detain citizens and non-citizens without the standard constitutional protections. At the same time, the administration has imposed unprecedented secrecy, making it more difficult for Congress, the courts, and citizens to hold the government accountable. This is despite increasing evidence, including evidence this week and last week from Congress, that the federal intelligence agencies failed to properly respond to an astonishing number of indications that the Qaeda terrorists were plotting against America in the years leading up to September 11th. This is also despite past intelligence agency abuses, such as the FBI's campaign in the 1960s to get UC President Clark Kerr fired, as recently disclosed in the San Francisco Chronicle. The USA Patriot Act, that stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. That's a really nifty acronym for a piece of legislation that's 342 pages long and amends more than 15 different laws. It was hastily approved by Congress and signed by President Bush on October 26 after little debate, yet it is one of the biggest expansions of police powers in decades. Some examples of the government's expanded powers under the act. FBI agents may request business records, which could include library, bookstore, and subscription records, and possibly reporters' unpublished and confidential notes when agents believe the information may be relevant to a terrorism investigation. The person whose records are sought need not be a target of the investigation, and the library, bookstore, or publication that receives the court order is barred from even disclosing it. The Act modifies the Bank Secrecy Act to require financial institutions to more closely track suspicious transactions and share reports about them upon request with government agencies, including the CIA. The law also grants federal agents secret access to personal credit reports. The Act boosts the FBI's power to trace internet traffic and collect electronic address and routing information that shows what websites law-abiding citizens are visiting. Agents need only certify to a court that the information is, quote, relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. The Act also makes it easier for the FBI to use wiretaps, bugs, and break-ins to gather intelligence about U.S. citizens by lowering the standard to get such warrants from the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And finally, the Act is harshest on immigrants. According to David Cole, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, the law allows the government to exclude aliens based solely on political views, deport them based on innocent political associations, and detain them on the Attorney General's say-so. Of course, the Justice Department has also proposed Operation TIPS, which would have used postal and utility workers to report suspicious activity inside people's homes, but this plan brought so much criticism from Congress that the department has scaled it back, although it still plans to proceed with it. Meanwhile, there is the increasing evidence that previous laws already on the books, had enabled the FBI and the CIA to gather a huge amount of clues indicating that Bin Laden was targeting the United States. Now, there is no evidence that the agencies knew specifically about the September 11th attacks, but there is substantial evidence suggesting that the agencies failed to properly respond to the clues showing the nation should have been more on guard. The Bush administration has refused to say exactly what it knew before the attacks, and all this raises the question of whether the intelligence agencies truly needed such vastly expanded powers as provided by the Patriot Act and other measures. At the same time, the administration has expanded powers and more billions of dollars to pursue terrorists. The administration is closing down public scrutiny and reducing the possibility of accountability. Ashcroft has refused to fully reply to questions from the House Judiciary Committee about how it is using the Patriot Act, even though the committee has primary responsibility for oversight of the Justice Department. And not long after the terrorist attacks, President Bush issued an executive order that will keep secret papers of former presidents that were supposed to be made public under the 1978 Presidential Records Act. The administration claims that the order will help protect national security, but some historians are concerned that President Bush is seeking to hide embarrassing information about administration officials who previously worked for his father or for President Reagan. Also last year, Attorney General Ashcroft issued a memo to all federal agencies saying the Justice Department would defend in court all decisions to deny Freedom of Information Act requests if there was any sound legal basis for withholding information. This reverses Attorney General Janet Reno's policy, which required agencies to use their discretion to release information whenever there was no foreseeable damage. Critics believe the Ashcroft policy will encourage needless secrecy and potentially expensive litigation. Here in the Bay Area, we have seen how a concentration of secrecy and intelligence powers can go awry during times of great international tension. During World War II and the Cold War, the nation granted the FBI expanded powers to protect against spies and saboteurs, but the FBI misused its power. On June 9th, the Chronicle reported that thousands of pages of FBI documents obtained only after a 17-year legal fight showed that in the 1960s, the Bureau engaged in wide-ranging and unlawful intelligence activities at the University of California. The FBI did not want to release those documents. It claimed in court that disclosure of the records was not in the public interest, that the information had to remain secret to protect law enforcement and national security. But five federal judges ordered the FBI to release them, concluding the FBI had engaged in unlawful spying. Some of the documents show that the CIA and the FBI conspired to pressure UC's governing board of regents to harass faculty and students involved in dissent. The FBI misled the White House by sending President Lyndon Johnson allegations that UC President Clark Kerr had engaged in disloyal activity, even though the FBI had previously investigated these allegations and found them false. The FBI mounted a concerted campaign to get Kerr fired, a court found, because it disagreed with his campus policies and political views, even though there was never any evidence that he was disloyal. In a particularly ironic episode, an optional essay question on UC's English aptitude test for high school applicants in 1959 asked, "What are the dangers to a democracy of a national police organization like the FBI, which operates secretly and is unresponsive to public criticism?" Well, when J. Edgar Hoover heard this question, he hit the roof. He ordered his agents to mount what was essentially a covert public relations campaign intended to embarrass the university and which forced the university to retract the question and apologize to the FBI. But Hoover wasn't satisfied. He ordered agents to check the backgrounds of all 6,000 professors and staff members of UC around the state. The result was a 60-page report. Among its findings, 72 faculty members and students were listed in the Bureau's Secret Security Index, a list of people whom the FBI considered potentially dangerous to national security during a crisis and who would be detained indefinitely without judicial warrant. The report also found that 141 professors had committed miscellaneous misdeeds, such as writing a play that glorified the Chinese Communist Army. 54 professors or their family members subscribed or contributed to publications that the FBI deemed subversive. And 22 professors had been involved in, quote, illicit love affairs, homosexuality, sexual perversion, excessive drinking, or other instances of conduct reflecting mental instability. After the Chronicle story appeared, Senator Feinstein asked the FBI to respond. She wanted to know, does the FBI still keep a list of citizens to be detained in the event of a national emergency? The FBI has yet to respond, and that leaves us wondering whether 17 years from now, we'll be waiting to find out what the government is up to today.
Thank you, Seth. Our final panelist is Paul Weaver.
My assignment tonight is to say something about the media. And instead of talking about the media as institutions and relating them to foreign policy, the way other people already have done to an extent, I thought instead I would talk a little bit about Lewis Lapham and the media. And that in itself is already a big subject. Lewis has kind of hinted at the fact that he was editor of Harper's at a young age in the 70s, and then he lost Harper's and he got it back again in a dramatic turnabout of affairs. Lewis, as a journalist, of course, you read him all the time in Harper's every month. And now he has his latest book, mostly a collection of Harper's columns and essays, which I'd recommend to you, and which I would like to give you a kind of reader's guide to, and in the course of that, say a few words about Lewis Lapham and journalism, and Lewis Lapham, the journalist. Journalism, I will define, borrowing from one of the James brothers, I can never remember which one, but journalism is criticism of the moment at the moment. It's a very good definition. It covers a very broad range of activity. There are lots of different kinds of journalists and lots of different divisions within the world of journalism. And one of the most basic of these is the division between editors and reporters, and the equivalent in television and radio. Lewis clearly is an editor. And if you want to understand his book and understand and appreciate his writing and his lecture this evening, it helps, I think, to realize that Lewis is an editor. Now, an editor is defined by the fact that he has two main roles or functions in this world. One is to have lunch. And the other is to define reality. Now, you may think that that's at once too light and too heavy for any one person to do, let alone an editor, but actually every editor does both of those things, and above all, does those two things. They really do a lot of their useful work, going to lunch, chatting with authors and learning from them, but also sharing with them their view of the world. And that gets us to the second role of an editor, which is defining reality. Modern scholarship of the media often defines the editor as a gatekeeper, and his function is that of gatekeeping, sort of letting fish, you know, up the fish ladder or not up the fish ladder. But that's a very poor and limited definition of what an editor does. An editor controls, the editor controls, everything in his publication, what it looks like, how long it is, who's in it, what subjects are covered, what subjects are not covered, who will be allowed in, whose name won't be allowed to be mentioned. Every nuance of every sentence is considered and validated by the editor, and if he doesn't like it, he changes it. Editors are totally in control in the world of journalism. And Lewis is very much, I think, you can see that in his writing. So as a writer then, what is Lewis like? Well, I would say he's very much like an editor in his writing. By this I mean two or three different things. First, there's an amazing variety of disparate materials in a typical Lapham sentence or paragraph, and certainly in a typical Lapham page. There will be memories of his childhood in San Francisco, growing up, looking out over the San Francisco Bay and seeing the Navy ships at anchor during World War II. And three lines away from that, there will be a brief summary of what Thucydides said. And not far from that, there will be some report of a news story, according to the Associated Press, published 3 years ago on an obscure subject having to do with East Asia or American foreign policy. And then there will be flashbacks to Fifth Avenue parties that he has been to. And then back again to Thucydides or Aristotle. This somewhat unusual and exotic souffle is actually very typical of editors. They learn through a variety of different ways, and they sort of have all these different sources of learning at their fingertips at all times. And they're very personal. It's a very solipsistic world in some sense. What unifies it is only the fact that it's all passed through and into his mind. Now, another related aspect of an editor when he writes is to be found in the fact that he doesn't labor very heavily at any one point. Editors' writing sort of flits gracefully from one point to another point, from one bit of evidence to another memory, and back again. It all often hangs together if he's a good editor and writer, or if he has a good editor. But you wouldn't want to accuse this person of burning the midnight oil. His writing doesn't reek of learned tomes gone through for hours, for weeks, for months, for years on end. Quite the contrary. There's a kind of a souffle-like quality to the writing. And a third point, and this is very interesting in Lewis's writing, there's a certain hauteur, a certain almost air of an unfriendly way to put it would be sometimes pompous, sometimes condescending, sometimes comic, but always tutelary and a little formal. There's an air of that in much of his writing. Now, to some extent, Lewis clearly aspires to write in a somewhat comic vein, and I actually think that there's a close parallel between him and Mark Twain, but I won't get into that. And at other times, he's more scholarly, and I hear echoes of Henry Adams in Lewis's writing, and even poor Melville. But above all, I would simply say he writes like an editor. An editor knows the world is in need of his guidance and tutelage. And you can tell that in Lewis's deft, amusing, interesting, informative, but tutelary writing. Now, what is Lewis's view of the world? Well, you might guess, or some people might guess, given his views expressed on foreign policy, for example, that he has left-wing affinities in his politics. Others, especially others who read him 20 or 30 years ago, imagined that he was a conservative, but actually he's neither of those and never has been. Lewis is a constitutionalist. That's to say, he looks at the world sort of the way the founding fathers looked at their world. And what makes him weird, of course, is that the world has really changed a lot since the founding fathers were around. But never mind, that doesn't mean that the way Lewis looks at this, at our world, isn't right. In fact, I think it is right. Without belaboring it too much, I would connect Lewis's sort of founding fathers, classical, almost ancient view of our modern world. I would connect that with the fact that he is a journalist. In the book, and this is one of the best passages in the book, he tells the story of how he came back from the grand tour of Europe in 1957 or whenever, and realized he had to get a job. And so he interviewed at three places. One was the White House, one was the Washington Post, and one was the CIA. And he got an interview at the CIA, and he, for this interview, he'd prepared, he'd read his Thucydides and boned up on the English monarchy succession, and gone prepared to, you know, discuss high and historical matters of weighty importance for the new world power. And instead he was asked three questions, the most important of which was, does Muffy Hamilton wear a slip? Muffy Hamilton being apparently a girl much dated by Yaleys in the mid-50s. So Lewis was horrified by this, and instead he became a journalist. By which I mean, really, he committed himself to a line of work in which you are committing yourself to looking at the world from the viewpoint of the ordinary citizen, or the more or less ordinary citizen. A journalist doesn't have any special expertise, doesn't have any special authority. He looks at the world with the authority of the ordinary, the amateur citizen. And he looks at the world, therefore, from the perspective of ordinary everyday life, which is a perspective that has both moral and practical concerns blended in a complex way. And that's why I think his voice is so valuable, and that's why I hope you will all read him again soon. And with that, I will stop.
Thank you very much, Paul.